0.01. I also want to inform the public that if they would like to see the documents, materials for this meeting, the best way to do that is to go to the website, go to Minnesota House of Representatives, go to committees, and then go to taxes. And that will, if you look to the right, it will give you all the materials that you do need. So with that, Ms. Griska, if you would please call the roll.
Markhart.
Present.
Markhart, present. Lislegard.
Present.
Lislegard, present. Davids.
Davids, present.
Davids, present. Abaje.
Present.
Abaje, present. Carlson.
Carlson, present.
Carlson, present. Detmer.
Detmer, present.
Detmer, present. Garofalo.
Garofalo, present.
Garofalo, present. Gomez. Gomez. Her.
Her, present.
Her, present. Hertas.
Hertas, present.
Hertas, present. Howard.
Howard, present.
Howard, present. McDonald.
Tell you more about that, okay?
McDonald, here.
McDonald, present. Miller.
Miller, present.
Miller, present. Moran. Moran. Mortensen.
Present.
Mortensen, present. Robbins. Robbins. Sindel.
Present.
Sindel, present. Schultz.
Schultz, present.
Schultz, present. Stevenson.
Present.
Stevenson, present. Swidzinski.
Present.
Swidzinski, present. Joachim.
Joachim, present.
Joachim, present. Gomez. Moran. Robbins. We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Griska. And as those members, as they appear, I will make note of that as I'm informed that they've come on. So next thing on the agenda is approval of the January 27th, 2021 minutes. Representative Lislegard, would you care to move approval?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lislegard moves approval of the January 27th, 2021 minutes. Is there a second? Oh, there's no second. Oh, any debate? Hearing none, I'm going to call for the vote. If you would temporarily unmute yourself, all those in favor of the January 27th, 2021 Tax Committee minutes, please say aye.
Aye. Aye. You betcha.
Those opposed, say nay. The motion does prevail.
Seconded.
Also, I want to make note that Representative Robbins is in attendance. Also, members, make note of the February 1st referral to the Property Tax Division. So today, members, we're going to do an overview of federal conformity provisions and how they impact our state income and corporate taxes. And before staff begins that presentation, just a little bit of a background, especially for new members, is that every year the federal government makes changes to their tax laws. And most states are tied to the federal government's tax code in one way or another, and that's to make it more administratively simple and more efficient for taxpayers. And so there's a couple different ways in which states do that. There's something called rolling conformity, where a state would just automatically. So if the federal government makes a change, it would automatically make that same change in their state tax policy unless they voted not to make the change. Otherwise, it automatically occurs. Minnesota, we are a static conformity state, which means we conform to a specific date. And our date right now that we conform to in the 2019 tax bill was December 31st of 2018, which means anything the state has done after, and we're going to find out it's been quite a bit, we have to then vote to conform. So unlike a rolling conformity that they would vote not to conform, on a static conformity state, we have to, anything past December 31st, 2018, we have to vote to conform to that. And then some states go with what's called a selective, where they don't have a specific date. It's not an automatic rolling. They just kind of pick and choose. So with that, we're going to be looking at four congressional acts and two other acts and provisions dealing with the Paycheck Protection Program that have occurred after December 31st of 2018. And so a lot of times what happens is the federal government will pass something temporarily, and it will, of course, expire at a certain date. And what they did in December, right at the very end, is they ended up extending over 30 different tax items that were going to expire. Hence, when you hear us talking about passing extenders or conforming to extenders, that's what that is. It's the federal government, when they've decided to extend the temporary tax, now the state has to decide whether or not to do that or not. So, and Representative Davids will tell you this, that sometimes in the past, if there's only been a few extenders or a few conformity items we need to address, that we have done that at the beginning of the session. And of course, that would require everyone to be on board, the governor and four caucuses, and agreeing there's no amendments or whatever. So that has occurred. Now, of course, we know that this year it's a little more complicated than that. I have full intentions that the taxes committee is going to be conforming. It's just a matter of to what extent and to what degree. You know, one thing you're going to see today is that the total cost, if we were to conform to everything you're going to see today, it'd be about $774 million. And so what I would ask members to do, because it's going to be this taxes committee that's going to have to decide on this, is that as staff is making the presentation today, think about what would you consider as priorities that we should conform to, and then kind of what we can afford. And so, you know, at $774 million, we're probably not going to be able to do every one, and we're certainly going to have to prioritize. So that's what I would ask as we kind of go through this, to look at kind of the ones you think we should be really looking at and the cost and so forth. So what I'm going to ask, we'll start out with Mr. Clayman, Mr. Williams, have some slides present. We will take questions at the very end of that, and then Ms. Schill will go into the fiscal revenue estimate part of that. So with that, and Ms. Templin, Ms. Templin will be doing that, not Ms. Schill. So with that, Mr. Williams, would you care to begin?
Mr. Chair and members, can you hear me?
We can. Very good.
Mr. Chair, I'm having some difficulty hearing.
Okay. Can you hear me now? Mr. Williams, can you hear yet? Or we could start with Mr. Clayman and then go back to
Mr. Chair. Do you want to try one last time? Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now, Mr. Williams.
Very good. Okay. My apologies.
Very good.
Please so proceed. I'm going to try and share my screen here. Can everyone see that?
Yes, I can see.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Sean Williams from the House Research Department. I'm going to be talking with my colleague, Mr. Clayman, about income tax conformity items for the upcoming session. So as you indicated, there are several federal acts that have been enacted since the state last updated its dates. So we're currently conformed, as you mentioned, through December 31st, 2018. That was a conformity decision we made in the 2019 Omnibus Tax Bill. Since then, Congress has passed four significant federal tax acts. The four listed are the Further Consolidated Appropriations Act, the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, the CARES Act, and the Consolidated Appropriations Act 2021. There's also two smaller acts that affected the Paycheck Protection Program. We're not going to be talking, organizing the presentation based on these acts, because there's certain provisions that were repeated in multiple of these and were extended a couple of times in these different acts. So we're going to be focusing more on kind of the different thematic groupings of these the components of federal law. So I'll be discussing income tax extenders for individuals, provisions affecting charitable contributions, miscellaneous other individual provisions, disaster relief provisions, certain credits for employers related to COVID, the Paycheck Protection Program, and then my colleague, Mr. Clayman, will discuss loss rules, business income tax extenders, and some other miscellaneous business provisions. So as Chair Markwart mentioned, these tax extenders are a matter that are kind of created in federal law. They're provisions that are often extended 1, 2, 3, 4 years at a time, rather than being made permanent part of the federal tax code. So when the federal government extends them, Minnesota has to take action to conform to those changes for them to be incorporated for state purposes. The four provisions I'm talking about here, one of them is for volunteer firefighter benefits. So that's an exclusion from gross income for benefits paid to volunteer firefighters and EMTs. The slide has one minor mistake. The exclusion is for $50 per month in benefits paid. And so that was initially enacted in, it expired in tax year 2011 previously. In 2019, the Further Consolidated Appropriations Act extended it for 1 year. And then in December of last year, the Consolidation Appropriations Act extended it one more year, or actually made it permanent. So that's now a permanent part of federal law that we'd have to adopt. The next issue is the tuition deduction. The Further Consolidated Appropriations Act extended this above the line deduction that reduces adjusted gross income for tax years 18, 19, and 20. One potential good piece of good news from the perspective of conformity is that this provision was actually eliminated under the for tax year 21 and later under the Consolidated Appropriations Act 2021. And these higher education benefits were rolled into some of the federal credits. And because federal credits don't affect state liability, it's not going to be an issue of conformity going forward unless Congress revives it. There's also an exclusion for employer payments of student loans. You can see there it's up to $5,250 per individual. So if an employer makes a payment on one of their employees' student loans, that can be tax exempt up to $5,250. That provision was enacted in CARES for 1 year only, and then it's actually extended in the Consolidated Appropriations Act 2021 for five more years until tax year 25. Lastly, there's an exclusion from gross income for discharges of mortgages on a principal residence. This often happens when there's a short sale or a modification of a loan. So if the loan is sold for a price that is, if the mortgage is underwater, if there's a foreclosure perhaps, oftentimes when that is processed, a certain amount of debt will be forgiven for the individual. The general federal rules are that loan forgiveness is counted as income unless there's a specific exemption provided. I believe this was first enacted sort of during the Great Recession, and it's been extended on a year-to-year basis since then. So the two federal acts from the past two Decembers extended that from tax year 18 all the way through tax year 25. There's also a number of changes affecting charitable contributions. The first is the charitable contributions of non-itemizers. So Minnesota has its own itemized deduction for charitable contributions, but the federal government under CARES enacted a above-the-line deduction, reducing adjusted gross income for non-itemizers only. It's limited to cash contributions. For married taxpayers that file joint returns, the deduction is $300 in tax year 20. And the Act in December also provided an additional $600 for married taxpayers filing jointly in tax year 21. And that's only for individuals that don't itemize their deductions federally. Additionally, there's increases in the limitation on charitable contributions. Sort of the TCJA put that limitation at 60% of what's called the charitable contribution base in federal law. And for most taxpayers, that's just adjusted gross income. So CARES temporarily increased that limitation to 100% of adjusted gross income or 100% of the contribution base for cash contributions only. And similar, and that was extended in the Consolidated Appropriations Act in December. So that's for tax years 20 and 21. They also increased the limitation for corporations. So the limitation is under usual law is 10% of taxable income, and it was increased to 25% under CARES. And then there's also an increase in the food inventory donation limit, and that's increased from 15% to 25% of either a taxpayer's aggregate net income from all trades and businesses if you're an individual, or taxable income if you're a corporation. There's another of other what I'm calling miscellaneous provisions here. These aren't exactly extenders, but there are other changes that affect Minnesota liability. The Further Consolidated Appropriations Act expanded the allowable uses for Section 529 college savings plans. And so those can now, distributions from those savings plans can be used for student loan payments of the beneficiary of the account or their sibling, or for certain apprenticeship expenses. I put on here this employer student loan payments because it was first enacted in CARES. It was also discussed earlier on the extender slide because it was then extended again in CAA. There's also an exclusion from gross income for certain emergency financial aid grants that were provided to students under the CARES Act. There's special rules that were established for what the law calls coronavirus-related distributions from retirement accounts. And so individuals in certain circumstances that were affected by the pandemic could take a distribution from a retirement account of up to $100,000. The reason this affects sort of Minnesota liability is if those individuals took those distributions, they would then be sort of, the income would be added to their taxable income over a 3-year period. So it kind of shifts income between tax years for Minnesota purposes. Another sort of feature of recent federal tax laws are these disaster relief provisions. These have been extended periodically. We conformed to one of the federal disaster relief acts when we did conformity in 2019. One provision of them is that there's for people who are in disaster areas, they can also take special distributions from their retirement accounts of up to $100,000, and it's the same rules where the income gets included over 3 years. There's also an increase in the limitation for charitable contributions for disaster relief efforts. It goes up to 100% of AGI for cash contributions, similar to the provision that was in CARES for individuals that aren't in disaster areas. And then there's also rules for disaster-related casualty losses. And essentially, these are individuals who have property damage or other losses caused by the disaster. And they can claim an itemized deduction for the amounts of that. They can actually claim the standard deduction federally for their disaster losses. And that was an itemized deduction that was allowed federally before TCJA, but was repealed. So for individuals that experience losses, their losses are not covered by insurance. They can claim this itemized deduction if they're in a disaster area. There's also three business credits for employers that were included in first the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, then one in CARES, and they were extended in the December Act, the Consolidated Appropriations Act. The first two kind of go together. They're credits for paid family leave and paid sick leave. So under the Families First Act, employers were required to provide certain employers were required to provide paid sick leave or paid family leave, and for employers that provided that, they're eligible for this tax credit. It's a refundable 100% credit. So for the amount of compensation they provided, it could be, it's mostly for wages, but there's certain other compensation that qualifies for the credit. And then the federal government would give them a 100% refundable credit for doing that. And similarly, CARES established this employee retention credit which gave you a 50% tax credit for wages paid to employees if you were experiencing a hardship due to the pandemic. I mentioned earlier that tax credits typically don't affect Minnesota tax liability, but because the federal government was giving such generous credits in these instances to employers for wages they paid out, there's rules that say you can't deduct the wages as a business expense that you use to claim these credits. So these affect Minnesota liability because conforming to them would be conforming to the disallowance of the deductibility of related wages and other compensation. This is one of the few provisions because we're, by conforming to it, we'd be denying a deduction to businesses. You actually raise revenue by conforming to these provisions. The last section I'm going to talk about is the Paycheck Protection Program. So this is, most people are familiar sort of with what this program does, but it was sort of a business lending program through the Small Business Administration. Employers participated in it and they spent the amount lent to them on certain expenses, wages, rent, utilities, and mortgages, then they could get the loans forgiven. So there's essentially two main provisions related to PPP that are matters of conformity. The CARES Act included an exclusion from gross income for loans forgiven through this program. So I mentioned earlier that loan forgiveness is typically taxable, but there's a specific rule for the PPP program excluding loans forgiven through PPP from gross income. And then there's a second provision under the Consolidated Appropriations Act 2021 that says you can deduct expenses associated with the PPP program, even though the income was not taxable. And I think that it's helpful to maybe talk about what the usual rules for how this kind of income is treated federally and for state purposes. So I mentioned that loan forgiveness is usually taxable, but similarly, businesses usually cannot deduct expenses that are allocable to income that is wholly exempt from tax. So Minnesota has not conformed to the federal changes, so we're still operating under those usual rules. So that means for Minnesota purposes, loan forgiveness through PPP is included in gross income. It's potentially subject to tax, but businesses may, because that income is subject to tax, businesses may use associated expenses from PPP to as a deduction to offset that income. The new federal rules would say that loan forgiveness is not included in taxable income, and businesses can deduct associated expenses. So that section of the Internal Revenue Code, section 265, does not apply, meaning businesses can take a deduction that's allowed for expenses that are allocable from non-taxable income. That means that businesses that had PPP income, maybe a certain amount of PPP income, could take a deduction for expenses they used to qualify for PPP, even though the PPP income itself was not taxable. Businesses also could potentially generate a loss from that deduction. And I think that it might be helpful to look at this sort of example business here. So for Minnesota purposes under nonconformity, if a business had $500,000 in ordinary business income and then had $100,000 in forgiven PPP loans, their total business income would be $600,000. Likewise, if they had $400,000 of ordinary expenses and $100,000 of expenses associated with PPP, they would have $500,000 of total expenses. So their net income in that case would be $100,000. If we conformed to the federal treatment, those PPP forgiven loans would not be counted as income, but then because of the provision in the Consolidated Appropriation Acts allowing those expenses to be deductible, they could continue to deduct those expenses. Mr. Chair, I'm going to hand it over to my colleague, Mr. Clayman.
Mr. Clayman.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to start with the business provisions here relating to the four acts that Mr. Williams described that impact conformity in the state. And I think to begin with here on describing the losses, I think it's maybe worth just briefly describing what happened in the Tax Cut and Jobs Act back in 2017. In 2017, Congress in the Tax Cut and Jobs Act restricted the use of carrybacks except for certain businesses like farming businesses, and allowed those losses then to be generated, or allowed the losses generated to be carried forward indefinitely. In addition, the TCJA also limited the amount of losses that could be taken in a year to 80% of taxable income. So what happened then in the CARES Act is that it, as part of the relief package for businesses that Congress wanted to provide, they suspended a number of the loss rules from the TCJA. I guess one of the other ones that I should mention is the excess business loss limits, and that limited the amount of non-business income that could be offset by net operating losses that were related to a business. And so the CARES Act suspended those provisions for losses, and they also allowed carrybacks for 5 years, for tax years 2019, 2020, 2018, 2019, and 2020, and suspended the 80% limit, and then also suspended the excess business loss limit. So that was the CARES Act. In the CAA, that's the first row. The CAA also had to clarify how those CARES Act provisions related to farming losses, because the farming losses were still allowed to have a carryback. And so the farming loss provisions are mostly just clarifying. In addition, the TCJA also limited the amount of interest that could be deducted by a business to 30% of taxable income. And the CARES Act also increased that 30% limit under the TCJA to 50% for tax years 2019 and 2020. And the effect of that is that there's a bigger business interest deduction that these businesses can take in 2019 and 2020, and that will also interact with the carryback provisions for the net operating losses and will increase the amount of those carrybacks for many businesses. And then next slide. So those were the losses. We'll move into the business extenders. These are similar to the individual extenders that Mr. Williams talked about, but these are more related to the extenders for businesses. The first one is an exemption or an exception from the what are called the UNICAP rules under federal laws that require interest to be allocated to the aging period for certain types of alcoholic beverages. And the effect of this exception is that there's an interest deduction that's allowed for that interest. It doesn't have to be capitalized into the inventory of the products. And just to provide a little more context on that, the UNICAP rules require that a number of costs are capitalized to inventory, and then those costs would be deductible through the cost of goods sold deduction, or the COGS deduction. And that was made permanent. That's been an extender the last few years. In addition, both the FCAA and the CAA continued the or extended the Section 181 accelerated depreciation provision for certain film and live theatrical productions. And this allows those businesses to expense those production costs in the year that they're incurred. Otherwise, if those expenses were deducted under bonus depreciation, they'd have to wait until the property was placed in service, which for a film, for instance, usually means its release date. So that allows that deduction to be taken in an accelerated manner. There are a couple other business extenders that are probably going to be familiar to a number of members who've been on the committee for a while. The first is the motorsports complex recovery period. This is a depreciation related extender. It just extends the 7-year recovery period for motorsports complexes. I believe there's a typo on that too. It should say extended, that's extended through 2025, tax years in 2025. Also, just a technical note, on the first column, you can see where we've listed which federal acts these were extended in. So the first time in 2019 and then later. There's the recovery period for racehorses. Again, this is something that Congress does from time to time, and that just reduces the recovery period for racehorses from 7 years to 3 years. And then lastly on this particular page of extenders is the slightly accelerated depreciation schedules for business property on Indian reservations. And that was done for tax years in 18 through 2021. Then there's the biofuel plant deduction under federal law. This just extends that deduction that can be taken for property placed in service through 2021. This applies to second generation biofuels. Next is the energy efficient commercial buildings deduction. And that allows a deduction for certain energy efficiency improvements that are made. One of the features of the CAA is that this was made permanent and there was an inflator that was put on the maximum amount. And then there's this, there's a special rule for the sale of certain electric transmission property by electric utilities. And essentially this allows a certain portion of the gain on electric transmission property, including the sale of an ownership interest in a utility, to be recognized over the period of 8 years. And this I believe is related to certain restructuring plans that are required by FERC or state electric utility regulators. Finally, there are a few miscellaneous business provisions. Similar to the individual provisions. These are not necessarily extenders. These are just other miscellaneous provisions that affect businesses or people in a trade or business. So the first one is the educator expense deduction. Actually, that slide should say educator instead of education. This is a deduction that applies for classroom materials that are purchased by K-12 teachers and for professional development. And what the CAA did is it clarified that certain COVID-related supplies are gonna be allowed to qualify for that deduction. There's also in the CAA a depreciation for certain rental property that's owned by a real property business. This again goes back to some changes in the TCJA. So there's this pattern in the last couple of federal acts of going back to the TCJA and amending some of the provisions there. This essentially reduces the recovery period for certain real property that's held by these real property businesses. There's some more detail on that if anybody's interested, but that's, I think, the best way to sum it up. There's also in the CAA that passed last December, there's an exception from the limit on food and beverage deductions for business meals. And this exempts food and beverages provided by a restaurant from the 50% limit. So that means 100% of those food and beverage purchases are deductible if they're a business meal. And there's more to that one too. If members are interested, there are certain tests that the Treasury Department has come out with to determine whether that's going to be applicable. And then lastly, the CARES Act in 2020 fixed another TCJA-related provision. This was a technical error. It was called the retail glitch. The intent was to allow certain interior improvements to real property to qualify for bonus depreciation, but to do that, they had to amend the definition of qualified improvement property to 15-year property so that it would qualify, and they didn't do that. It didn't qualify for bonus depreciation. So the CARES Act fixed that issue. And that's all for the business provisions, conformity provisions. And so with that, Mr. Chair, our presentation is concluded.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Clayman and Mr. Williams, for that presentation. I really appreciate you grouping it in the items rather than going by each act. So that was very helpful. I appreciate that. So this will be the time for questions before we go to the fiscal note. And I know, one of these that really a lot of folks are talking about, very important, is the Paycheck Protection Program. And, my strong intent is that this tax committee will conform to that. It's to what extent is going to have to be the big debate. And my intent would be for the state to conform to the exclusion of the loan as counting as income. So basically, the loan would be tax-free. But as Mr. Williams has said, we have in state law that if there is income that is not taxed, then expenses that are allocated to that non-tax income is not deductible. So the second question and what the second part of the conformity would be, then would we allow expenses to be deducted to offset other income? And so that's going to be kind of the question. We're going to see that's going to cost, full conformity is about $438 million over the biennium. So unlike the federal government, we actually have to balance the budget. And so we do have limited resources. And so that is going to be something we're going to have to decide as we look at that. Is it to be targeted to those businesses, especially the leisure and hospitality industry that has been hit the hardest? So it's going to be a lot of thought process for our committee in regards to the Paycheck Protection Program besides others. But the intent certainly is to conform. It's just a matter of how much conformity there will be. So with that, I'll just look at Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair. I guess I have two questions. The first one is on page 11, the example that was provided. It showed a business that was profitable during the pandemic, but does this mean that like for a business that did not turn a profit, that they would receive no tax benefit? Is that correct?
Mr. Williams, so probably that chart, I think that might have been 11 where you had the example there. So if you've got like a restaurant or a bar that might not have had income certainly this year, what happens there?
Chair Markwart and Representative Herr, in that case, the business would still benefit, but not immediately. So they would have no taxable income in their current year. If we fully conformed to the exclusion from gross income and then the allowance of the deduction for associated expenses, that business would essentially have less net income. They would have a larger net operating loss if we gave them the tax treatment that is allowed federally. And so they could then, under federal law, they could carry those losses back up to 5 years if it was in tax year 2020. And even if we didn't conform to those federal loss rules, they could still, and for Minnesota purposes, carry forward that loss. So if a business was in a loss position, they would still benefit from the state conforming on that, in that they would get this kind of net operating loss carry forward.
Representative Herr.
Yeah, so I guess that, thank you, Chair. So I guess that would lead me to just wondering then what would be the difference in taxes paid for businesses that turned a profit versus those that didn't. And I don't know if I need an answer. I guess it's just making me think about what that looks like. I did just have one other question on page 6 and 7 talking where it talked about the distribution of retirement funds. So I know that what this is addressing is how the income is addressed, right? And that they have 3 years to But I guess what I'm wondering is, does that mean that there's no relief on the penalty side for taking out the funds from retirement accounts? Because I know that if somebody is qualified to do so or not, there are different tax implications for them. And so I guess I'm just curious if, like, if this is just for people who are qualified to withdraw funds out of their accounts, or is this anybody who needed to at some point take out funds from those accounts, whether it was for hardship reasons or different reasons? Is there, there's no relief on the penalty piece of it if you're an unqualified individual? Is that correct?
Mr. Williams.
Chair Mark Wharton, Representative Herr, the penalties are all kind of are imposed federally, and so the mm-hmm. federal legislation actually did give penalty forgiveness for early withdrawals, and that was kind of okay. part of the idea behind this, is if you
That's
had
great.
Financial hardship, then potentially you could use retirement funds to sort of get you through this period. There's also additional rules sort of allowing catch-up contributions, so you could potentially okay. in the next kind of 3 years do catch-ups to pay this back to your retirement accounts, but we focus on sort of the spreading the income over 3 years, because that's the only piece that sort of has an effect on Minnesota liability. But the federal law does allow that.
Perfect. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me okay?
We can.
Good. And Mr. Chairman, I forgot to say this in a previous meeting. You know, it's good to be back on the tax committee where I belong, rightfully torturing yes. you on a daily basis. So I just wanted to say thank you. It's just good to see you again. So
that's very good. Wouldn't want it any other way, Representative.
A question for Mr. Klayman or Mr. Williams. On page 11 on that Paycheck Protection Program that Representative Herr mentioned, there's a tax rate, it says a tax assuming 7.5% rate. Where does that 7.5 rate come from?
Mr. Williams.
Chair Mark Wharton, Representative Garofalo, we often, when we're doing sort of example calculations, assume a 7 or 7.5% rate. That it was invented in this case by me. I think you could, a taxpayer that was in a higher tax bracket in Minnesota could have a higher rate, and a taxpayer that was in a lower tax bracket in terms of taxable income might have a lower rate. And when we're coming up with examples, we often sort of use a middle rate that's in between the distribution of the brackets.
Okay. All right. Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to nonpartisan staff. So that would mean that if the it would be higher if the governor's job-killing tax increases were enacted, but I'll save that question for another time. So then when it comes to the PPP loan forgiveness issue, Mr. Chairman, I assume this is for tax year 2020, correct?
I believe, yes, correct, okay. Representative Garofalo.
And yes. So, Mr. Chairman, as I've highlighted before, I have concerns about there being a large omnibus tax bill that usually waits until May or maybe even June. But this would be for tax bills that are due April 15th. Is there any plans or any negotiations to maybe move the PPP issue previous to April 15th so people don't have to pay that higher tax burden or businesses don't have to?
Representative Garofalo, in the best of worlds, yes, it would be nice to move some of these forward. But I mean, just the cost of it, we're first going to have to find out what the February forecast says. And then because this is significant, it's going to have to be part of our overall target and budget on the tax bill. So it's always, more efficient for taxpayers if you can do it actually right away, probably in January. We're actually getting to the point now where filing starts in a week, basically, and even, software companies and so forth would even have problems. But, yeah, it's just not going to be possible this year, Representative Rob.
Okay. So, and Mr. Chairman, I do understand that there is some nuance in the Paycheck Protection Program that the full cost of it, and that there's different ways to address that, and I recognize that. And certainly there are other issues that can be involved. I don't want to speak for Representative Davids or my caucus, but it would just seem like we're going to have an already more angry and agitated public, even more angry and agitated at us, if these business owners are going to be submitting their taxes and paying this, and then we're going to true up with them after the fact. It would seem that all of us would have a vested interest in not playing the standard amendment games and doing something on this separately and earlier, definitely before April 15th. And I just wanted to offer that suggestion. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing this forward and having this overview. I'm anxious to hear the fiscal note as well. I think it's hard for the public to understand sometimes that conformity actually can cost money. It's more complicated and doesn't fit into a snappy headline or tweet or a bumper sticker. So I had a quick question on slide 6, just trying to understand it. On the coronavirus related distributions from the entire retirement account, that's up to $100,000. Just curious to what qualifies as a coronavirus related distribution.
Mr. Williams.
Chair Mark Wharton, Representative Joachim. I don't have the exact rules in front of me. I can provide that to you via email, but I think it's a lot of it has to, I think it's the general concept is that there has to be some sort of economic hardship or health related hardship due to the coronavirus. But I'd have to get back to you with the details.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. That, and thank you, Mr. Chair. That would be helpful. I'm assuming it's something like if you couldn't pay your rent and you had to pull from your retirement account, et cetera. But another quick question, or maybe just a comment on the education expense deduction. That is a wonderful deduction that teachers use all the time, and there's never enough deducted for what they actually spend in the classroom because teachers spend a lot of money out of their pocket. And I wasn't sure, was the, you know, it's great to extend it to coronavirus related expenses, but just want to point out that teachers should not have to buy their own PPE or hand sanitizer or bleach. This shouldn't be something we're having to expect them to do that we then have to give them a small deduction on their taxes. Just wanted to throw that out there.
Thank you. Representative Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also have a question about PPP. I'm trying to understand the impacts for a PPP loan recipient under our current law, if we did not conform. Would that result in an additional tax burden on that filer, or would it be neutral?
Mr. Williams.
Chair Mark Wharton, Representative Howard, I think it kind of depends on what baseline you're measuring against. So relative to conformity, there would be a higher tax liability. So that example I provided shows a higher tax liability in that instance. If the taxpayer has, in the example I gave is $100,000 PPP loan, then they use associated wages and expenses to fully offset that $100,000 loan, then there's no change in their liability. Sort of the other kind of baseline question is to what extent would the wages and other expenses used to offset that loan have been paid out had they not received the loan? And that's sort of, I think, you sort of have to know that to sort of know what their kind of situation would be in the absence of PPP. So it's really hard to answer that question. It kind of depends on what baseline you're measuring against.
Representative Howard.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Mr. Williams.
I don't see any more hands up at this time, but I don't want to move forward if I'm missing someone. Okay, I think we will move on. And again, Mr. Williams, Mr. Clayman, thank you. I just, like I said, I really like it that it's put into categories. And so now let's look at the fiscal side of things. Ms. Templin.
Mr. Chair, this is Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. Are you able to see my screen?
We are.
Okay, excellent. And it sounds like you can hear me as well. Good signs. Okay, let me put this in full screen mode. Okay, very good. Again, my name is Cynthia Templin, and good afternoon. I am with the House Fiscal Staff. And today, the purpose of the presentation today is to provide an overview of the federal update tracking sheet, which shows the change in revenue with federal conformity to provisions enacted by Congress as of December 27, 2020. This tracking sheet is a compilation of all the revenue estimates, which you should have received for the five federal acts. And if you have time, I would encourage you to review the estimates because they show the Department of Revenue's assumptions and data sources used to make the estimate. And in some cases, the estimate does provide detail about the number of returns affected. Since this is our first tax hearing using using revenue estimates and a tracking sheet, I want to spend just a few minutes covering the basics. First of all, the tracking sheets show the estimated change in general fund dollars for each provision. The estimated change for a provision is either a revenue increase or a revenue decrease. A revenue increase shows as a positive number, and a revenue reduction shows as a negative number. Also, all dollars are in thousands in the tracking sheets and in the revenue estimates. So something that shows negative 6,700 in fiscal 22 is really a revenue reduction of 6.7 million in the revenue estimate and in the tracking sheet.
Ms. Templin, should we be seeing a sheet that has numbers on it yet, or is it just?
Mr. Chair, yes, this is just my preface to the okay. Spreadsheet. Right. That will come next.
Okay, we're just seeing the overview of tracking.
Yes.
Okay, very good. Okay. I didn't.
And on that note, it does make sense. Why don't we go to the first page?
Okay, no, that's fine. I just didn't know if you had switched and it hadn't worked.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I was just creating suspense for the spreadsheet, if ever that's
yes,
possible.
You got me.
So the tracking sheet shows the revenue change for the budget window. And the budget window covers two biennia, as you can see, fiscal 22 and 23, and then the tails years or the planning years, fiscal 24 and 25. Finally, these estimates and the tracking sheet will change because sometimes they are corrected. So always check the dates of the revenue estimate and the spreadsheet, and the estimates also change because they are affected by the economic forecast by MMB. So we will see new estimates again, or revised estimates, come February. So on that, let's get started looking at the spreadsheet. Mr. Clayman and Mr. Williams just summarized provisions related to extenders, charitable contributions, and so on. This tracking sheet is organized by Federal Act. It's organized that way because it's consistent with a revenue estimates presentation. The tracking sheet is a good budget tool. And when we go through this tracking sheet, there are several ways. All right, decisions need to be made during session and conference committee time on how to conform. And there are several options to consider. For example, you could decide to conform to provisions for previous tax years that have already passed. And this would be retroactive conformity. You could conform to one tax year only. You could also conform prospectively for the current tax year or for future tax years, or you could conform to all tax years authorized by Congress. This is the biggest price tag. And at the end of this presentation, we will see the total revenue change with conformity to all provisions enacted by Congress. So starting now to focus on the tracking sheet, line one of the spreadsheet shows estimates for the Further Consolidated Appropriation Act. And as Mr. Williams said, this was enacted in December 2019 by Congress, and it was enacted before the pandemic. This act contains many extenders, such as exclusions or deductions on lines 3 through 7. And it also includes business extenders on lines 16 through 23. In addition, it also includes disaster relief provisions. Most of these provisions were enacted by Congress for tax years that have passed, for tax years 18, 19, and 20. And you can see that in the effective date column. The revenue estimate allocates the retroactive revenue change from previous years to fiscal 2022. In the spreadsheet, you will see most of the revenue change for this act, again, is focused on fiscal 22 with a trailing revenue changes for fiscal years for other fiscal years in the forecast window. So if I could bring your attention to line 35 of the spreadsheet, this shows the total estimated revenue reduction for this act. It is a revenue reduction of $25.12 million in fiscal 22 and a revenue gain of $1.210 million in fiscal 23. And you can see, again, most of the cost, the revenue reduction is in fiscal 22 for the provisions that are for tax years that have passed. I will go to the next act on page 2. On page 2, looking at line 37, this shows the estimates for the CARES Act. This is enacted in March 2020 by Congress, enacted at the start of the pandemic. So provisions enacted by Congress are reflective kind of at that, you know, of what happened at that point in time. The federal act contains several provisions related to charitable contributions for individuals. It's on lines 40 through 42, and for corporations, it's on lines 50 and 51. As you can see in the effective date for this act, a lot of the provisions were effective for one tax year only, and you can see the associated or the related revenue impact on those lines. The federal act also contains several provisions for businesses. There are employee retention credits for employers. On line 44, this was a revenue gain. You can see there of $12 million in fiscal 22. There are also provisions related to business losses, which were effective for 2 years. I also want to direct your attention to line 45 of the spreadsheet on this page. Mr. Klayman discussed the changes to net operating losses, and you can see the revenue reduction for that provision is estimated to be $244.4 million in fiscal 22. And again, most of the revenue impact is in fiscal 22 because it's including the revenue reduction from previous years for the tax year 18, 19, and 20. And then finally, for the CARES Act on line 60, this shows the general fund, the total estimated general fund revenue change. And I'm just going to jump to the biennial impact of $282.2 million for fiscal 22 and 23 and $1.1 million in fiscal 24 and 25. And then moving down the sheet on line 62, you see estimates for the Families First Act. And this estimate also includes the Consolidated Appropriation Act for the federal tax credits for paid sick leave and medical leave. This provision has a revenue gain. It's a revenue raiser. On line 74 of $56.6 million in fiscal 22, you can see the estimate shows that to be a one-time revenue gain in fiscal 22 only for conformity to these provisions. Turning to page 3. Line 76 shows the estimates for the Consolidated Appropriation Act, and this was enacted in just recently, just over a month ago, in December 2020. In this act, we see the return of a few extenders authorized by Congress for five years. For example, on line 78 is the exclusion of discharge of indebtedness on qualified principal residents. This, as you can see, the cost of this provision, the spread of the revenue reduction is over kind of the span of the budget window because it's in this act, it's effective for the the current tax years and for five future tax years. Line 80 is another example of an extender. It's the exclusion of certain employer student loan payments. Lines 97 through 102 and 107 through 113 are extenders for business expensing provisions. And again, a lot of these were enacted for five tax years. In this act, in the Consolidated Appropriation Act, we do see some new provisions, such as the modification of the educator expense deduction, which includes PPE expenses, and that's on line 84. That is a permanent change, an ongoing change, and that has a revenue reduction of $40,000 in fiscal 22 and 23. In addition, in this act, another new kind of feature of this act is the exclusion of the economic impact disaster loan advances on line 106. It's the exclusion of income. This has a revenue reduction of $3.7 million. In the fiscal 22 and 23 biennium. So turning to page 4, we see on line 114, the total estimated revenue reduction for the Consolidated Appropriation Act of $87.36 million and $22.62 million. Again, a revenue reduction in the out years. So moving on, the last federal conformity provision that I just want to bring your attention to are the estimates for the Payment Protection Loan Forgiveness Program. So there were three federal appropriations for these loans by Congress. The estimate assumes that Minnesota will receive $17.4 billion in loans in tax year 20 and tax year 21. So if there are more appropriations, this estimate will change. More appropriations by Congress, this estimate will change. But based on, you know, where we are today, the Department of Revenue has provided this estimate, and it is, I'll just move to line 134, a cost in the fiscal 22 and 23 biennium of $437.8 million and $39.3 million in the tails. The cost of this, of conformity to this provision is affected by whether or not conformity also includes the NOL modifications in the CARES Act. The cost is higher in the current biennium if there is conformity with the NOL provisions in the CARES Act. It's higher in the current biennium, but less in the tails. If there's not conformity, the cost in the tails is slightly higher for conformity to this loan exclusion from income. I will just move on from that provision to bring you to the grand total for conformity, the total estimated general fund revenue change for conformity to all federal provisions through December 27th, 2020 is on line 139. It shows a total revenue reduction and the chair has already discussed this of being $774.6 million, a revenue reduction in fiscal 22 and 23, and a revenue reduction in the tails of $61.33 million. And again, this is based on the current, these are estimates that are based on current law. Mr. Chair, that concludes my presentation. Thank you. Oh, you're on mute.
Ms. Taplin, thank you so much for that. Are there any questions for Ms. Templin on FISCO numbers and so forth? I don't see any questions. So, again, there's going to be a lot of discussion. I really ask all members to kind of think about what items in there are priorities and, you know, what type of financial commitment would we want to make. And, of course, that will depend on targets and so forth going down the road. But as we've discussed before, a universal goal of this committee is to help individuals and businesses hit and impacted by COVID-19. And so it doesn't all have to occur through the tax code. I mean, there can be, you know, grants and other appropriations from other committees that can also help. But there certainly are things we can do in the tax code, but that certainly isn't going to be everything as you kind of think about the whole realm of how we can help individuals and businesses. So I don't see anything else. Because of such great behavior today, I'm going to give you tomorrow off. Members, we have tomorrow off. And Thursday, we'll come back to hear the tax provisions in Governor Waltz's budget. And we'll go from there. So members, we'll see you back on Thursday. Thank you again to Mr. Williams, Mr. Clayman, Ms. Templin, and members' attention today. Members, we are adjourned.